Chapter 26, Rigu, the Final Years, 1976 to 1993. The headmasters in the final years of Rigu were brothers John Paul Mauro, 1976 to 1980, Peter Page, 1981 to 1983, Bertrand Webster, 1984 to 1985, Brian Leake, 1986 to 1987, and Julian Huckerman, 1988 to 1990. During these years, the community was fully involved with the high school at Rigu, and from 1979 to 1983, Brother Bernard Kangu taught at the community school at Tubiana, immediately adjacent to the Rigu campus. The first Bougainvillean headmaster. John Mauro's appointment as headmaster of St. Joseph's Rigu in 1976 was a significant move for the brothers, who felt that after almost 30 years of Australian headmasters, the time was right for a Bougainvillean to take over the school. Indeed, all over the newly independent nation of Papua New Guinea, similar moves towards localisation of school leadership were occurring. To prepare future national headmasters in Papua New Guinea, the Education Department sponsored a series of courses which were conducted in Australia by the Australian School of Pacific Administration, a division of the Department of External Territories. Brother Bertrand Webster arranged for John Mauro to participate in one such course in 1974. John reminisces about this course, which he found helpful, enjoyable, and informative in more ways than one. Quote, 16 of us went to Australia to undertake a course which would prepare us to become school principals or deputies. During the six-month course, I got to know Peter Barkey well. He and I did the course together, and he is now, in 2002, the Secretary for Education in PNG. We became good friends in Sydney. The course was held at a place called Bobbin Head. We used to sleep in different parts of Mossman and go by bus to Bobbin Head to attend classes. I stayed with the brothers' community in Mossman, where Brother Bernard Murphy looked after me well. The course was excellent, and we all enjoyed it and learnt a lot about administration. There was a good spirit among the 16 Papua New Guineans, and we felt that we were preparing for something special. We took part in everything, especially entertaining visitors. We put on our cultural dances. When we went to visit other schools, we were able to see headmasters in action. If they asked us to do something cultural, then we would put on some kind of sing-sing. During this time, I became aware of something that I did not experience when I was in Australia in the 1950s, training to become a Maris brother. I realised there were Pamuk Marys in Australia. A Pamuk Mary is a prostitute. As time went on, I used to call in at the hostel where some of the teachers were sleeping, and sometimes I would see some ladies who came in to spend the night with our teachers. Many of these men had left their sweethearts or their wives at home, and so, during the 6 months we spent down there, I suppose some would find ways to overcome their loneliness. It was an eye-opener for me. Not long after our course began, a doctor gave a talk warning of the dangers of sexually transmitted diseases. The doctor advised us to take precautions against catching these diseases if ever we invited these women to our houses. He suggested we should nominate a person who would take care of the condoms and medicines. The teachers voted for me, and I didn't know what I should do. My best friend Peter Barkey came to me and said, "Brother John, don't you worry about that. They are all grown-up men. They can look after themselves." So that was what happened, each man for himself. I was very relieved then. End of quote. On his return to Bougainville, Brother John's training was called on when he was invited to become the first national headmaster of Rigu. John continues his story. Quote, "After 6 months, we returned to our schools. As soon as I came back to Rigu, Brother Bertrand asked me to work as a deputy for a while. And then, soon after that, they asked me to take over as headmaster of Rigu High School. When I took over in 1976, I was happy to see the inspector coming to visit my school. It was none other than Mr. Peter Barkey, who was my friend at the headmaster's course. So, with Peter Barkey, we got on very well. But he was critical of many things. I reacted against all this criticism. He said to me, "Brother John, if your school was not running well, I wouldn't criticize it much. But because it is running so well, I criticize it. I pick up these small points, hoping that it will get even better than it is." So that was encouraging for me and for the teachers, who noted that our school was running just as well as it had under Brother Bertrand Webster. The teachers were happy, and my students were happy. Peter Barkey was always happy when he came to our school. He showed that by occasionally taking me to Kieta, to the hotel, where we would buy a couple of drinks, sit in his room, and share stories about our training and our families. He was a very good inspector and a helpful one. End of quote. The Marburi Project. Land was a precious resource at the Rigu campus. No spare land was available for gardens immediately adjacent to their school. Until the late 1960s, Rigu used diocesan land at Toniva, just south of Rigu, for growing vegetables. At the time, the government decided to move its administration from Sahano Island in the north to central Bougainville, a decision taken independently of Bougainville Copper's plan to develop the town of Arawa. When government authorities were looking for land in central Bougainville for a residential area, Bishop LeMay sold the Toniva land, creating a problem for Rigu's food production. As an alternative, the bishop promised that diocesan land at Marburi, about 60 kilometres north of Kieta, would be available for garden production for the school. The Diocesan Brothers Congregation, Brothers of St. Joseph, BSJ Brothers, worked the farm, and the mission boats transported produce to Rigu. By 1976, the demands on mission boats and the inconvenience of such transport created difficulties. About that time, the main highway from central Bougainville to the northern end of the island was constructed, enabling road transport to be used for carrying garden produce from Marburi to Rigu. Bishop LeMay therefore requested the school to take responsibility for the Marburi garden. Brother Terry Tanzer, who arrived at Rigu in 1975, looked after the Marburi gardens and made frequent trips, assisted by Brother Chris Marden and later Brother Mark Humphreys. Although the brothers employed some part-time workers at Marburi, adequate supervision from distant Rigu was difficult, and the occasional theft of produce from the gardens occurred. In 1978, a grant from Australia was used to purchase a large truck for the Marburi project. A significant development occurred in 1980 with the beginning of a Year 8 program, which involved groups of 40 students on a rotating basis, residing at Marburi for several weeks each term. The course at Marburi was designed to teach appropriate skills for students returning to village life. At that time, about one-third of students left school after grade 8. However, the course was designed for all students, not only those who would complete their schooling in Year 8, and therefore normal academic subjects continued at Marburi, although with reduced time allocation. Most daytime classes covered agriculture, building skills, gardening, raising animals, and building village-style accommodation. Other staff who assisted with the project in later years included brothers Reginald Frondier, Ian McCombie, Chris Marden, Bernard McGrath, Bernard Leake, Felix Coniana, and Mr. Bruno Idioi, a local Nasioi man who was the farm manager for some years. Brother Ian McCombie describes the rationale and approach of the Marburi project as it operated in the mid-1980s. Quote, "A big need at that time was to do something about the Grade 8 lever situation. So we decided we would make Grade 8 levers the thrust of Marburi. We would aim to teach all Grade 8s something that would make them useful when they left school, whether it be at the end of Grade 8 or Grade 10. The program had several aspects to it. Agriculture, building with both traditional and Western materials, small business management, and self-esteem. We developed a series of units, each one of 3 weeks' duration. Each class came up for 3 weeks on rotation each term. For example, for the unit poultry, we used that theme in every subject. In science, we covered the biology of chickens and birds in general. Commerce lessons covered how to run a chicken business and how to keep the accounts. In English, we wrote business letters about ordering chickens and chicken feed. In practical skills, we built the chicken houses. Agriculture was the subject in which we taught how to raise chickens. The next term, there would be a new topic, for example, cocoa or pigs." End of quote. In 1986, some extra funding for the project became available through a nationally sponsored secondary schools community education program, SSCEP, which promoted the objectives the brothers had already established at Marburi. With some interruptions, the Marburi project continued until St. Joseph's Rigu closed in 1990. Throughout the period, excess farm produce was sold at roadside stalls or to the Panguna mine to assist the financing of the project. In 1988, it was thought that Marburi would be a good place to set up a Marist training house, postulancy. To that end, Chris Marden and his helpers constructed a large house with 8 bedrooms. Soon after the building was completed, the Bougainville crisis erupted, and the building was never used for its intended purpose. When the Marburi Education Centre opened on the site in 1999, this building became the brothers' residence. The last Rigu building projects. During Peter Page's time as headmaster, a double-storey brick building was constructed, a dormitory classroom block in the traditional Rigu design of dormitories above classrooms. This was the first dormitory classroom block at Rigu to be constructed in brick. A similar adjoining block was added some years later. A modern dining room block, completed in 1990, was never fully operational because the Bougainville crisis caused the closure of the school. Onset of the Bougainville crisis. Stuart Tapuri, from Paru Paru in the mountains near Panguna, was a Year 7 student at Rigu in 1990, the final year of operation of the school. With numerous other young men in similar situations, he joined the Bougainville Revolutionary Army, BRA, after the closure of the school, and in 2000 was able to resume his schooling at the recently opened Marburi Education Centre. His story, typical of hundreds of others, captures something of the tragedy of these events. Quote, "I came from Paru Paru to Rigu in 1990. I'd never been down to Arawa town, and I'd never seen Panguna mine. As a small boy, I was anxious when I came down from my village because there were so many cars to see and so many people in the town. When I arrived at the school, I was very amazed to see so many white men there. I can't remember all their names, except for Brother Brian Leek, who was the deputy. The lay teachers at that time were all Bougainvillians. I remember Vincent Solly from Booker, Wilfred Lessey and his wife Rita, and Paul Lapun from Siwai. Brother Julian Huckerman was headmaster. I liked all those teachers, and they taught us many interesting things, and I was very happy at Rigu. During term one, school went on as normal. Many of the white people were leaving the island at that time because the mine had closed, and the police and the army were getting ready to leave Bougainville. There were just a few small disturbances at the school during the term, caused by some of the BRA who came to steal the cars from the school. But the BRA commander, Ishmael Torawama, stopped them. We went home for term one holidays, but when we returned, Brother Julian told us to go back to our villages for the time being. Some of our belongings had been stolen during the holidays. The power was off, and some of us thought this was the reason for the school closing. No fuel at Lolahoe Power Station. But maybe there were other reasons why the school closed. Anyway, the school never reopened after that. I went back to the village, joined the BRA, and stayed in the bush fighting. I grew up in the bush with the big boys. I was very sad at that time because my education had been blocked. I believed I didn't have a future. When I was in the bush staying with the BRAs, I heard that some BRAs burnt down our school, and that made me very sorry. When I heard that Mabiri was open, I made up my mind to come out of the bush and attend school in 2000. I was very pleased. End of quote. As already noted in chapter 12, the complete story of the Bougainville crisis is beyond the scope of this book. A brief background, however, necessary to understand the events surrounding the closure of St. Joseph's Rigu, is given here. A new Panguna Landowners Association, PLA, was formed in 1987, comprising people who were not satisfied with the existing compensation arrangements between the old association and Bougainville Copper Limited, BCL. A significant person associated with the new association was Rigu ex-student Francis Ohner, who, until 1988, was employed at Panguna Mine as a haul truck operator. When the PLA made a new series of claims against BCL, the PNG government commissioned a new inquiry into the impact of the mine's operation. On 18 November 1988, Ohner, dissatisfied with the resulting report, stormed out of a public meeting at Arawa at which the report was presented, and never again returned to his job at the mine. That evening, during an interview on the national broadcaster, NBC, Ohner informed listeners that the PLA had decided to force the closure of the mine. 4 days later, a large amount of explosives were stolen from a mine storehouse, and on 26 November, a pylon carrying the power line from the power station to the Panguna mine site was blown up, toppling it and cutting off the power necessary to operate the mine. Some days later, the power was restored, only to have it disrupted again within 24 hours by another toppled pylon. Simultaneously, various other acts of sabotage hampered the mine's operations. A large contingent of police from mainland PNG, dispatched to quell the saboteurs' activities, imposed and vigorously enforced a dusk-to-dawn curfew. Francis Ohner and his band of supporters disappeared into the mountains southeast of Panguna in the Kongara area, from where future operations against the mine were coordinated. At some point, the purpose of the conflict widened from sabotage against the mine to include the long-held aspirations of some Bougainvillians for secession from Papua New Guinea. During the first half of 1989, every attempt to restart the mining operation was met with further sabotage. In June of that year, Prime Minister Namalu declared his government's intention to deal with the Panguna criminals, and backed the threat with a huge escalation of police and defence force operations in central Bougainville. During the following months, the war atrocities, which were perpetrated by both sides and became a regrettable characteristic of the crisis, began in earnest. In September 1989, the company decided to halt all attempts to reopen the mine and began immediate repatriation of all non-Bougainvillean mine personnel. By February of the following year, this withdrawal of company personnel was all but complete. A ceasefire was brokered in March 1990, and within several weeks, all government forces, police, military, and correctional service officers had been withdrawn, leaving the BRA in apparent control of the entire islands of Bougainville and Booker. Francis Ona had difficulty in controlling his troops, and considerable looting of premises and terrorizing of civilians resulted. In May 1990, attempting to force a return to PNG control, the government imposed a blockade on Bougainville, preventing shipping and airlines from servicing the island. On 17 May, Francis Ona unilaterally declared that Bougainville was independent of Papua New Guinea. In August 1990, the New Zealand-brokered Endeavour Accord promised a speedy end to the blockade. The agreement collapsed within weeks, and although the blockade had been officially lifted, in reality it persisted, as services were restored only gradually. In October 1990, the PNG Defence Force, PNGDF, returned, first to Booker Island and soon after to Bougainville. During this time, fierce conflicts continued between different groups of Bougainvillians. Care centres were established at several locations on the island to provide refuge for many displaced villagers. Many others abandoned their homes and fled to more secluded locations to avoid conflict. In spite of repeated attempts at peace negotiations, the conflict continued until January 1998, when the Lincoln Agreement effectively ended 9 years of civil war. The ceasefire came into force in May of that year, and an international group of unarmed peace monitors was invited to assist in observing the peace process. So that's the end of our very brief explanation of how the Bougainville crisis began and officially ended. Now we move on to crisis years at St. Joseph's Rigu. As 1989 progressed, staff and students followed the ominous events in around the Panguna mine with growing alarm, although the school year progressed smoothly enough. The school community, along with most Bougainvillians, believed that these problems, although serious, would be resolved in time. Few foresaw the calamity about to envelop the island. In January 1990, a group of militants, BRA, briefly occupied Toniva, resulting in a prompt retaliation from the PNG Defence Force. The gunfire exchange, grenade explosions, and misdirected mortars landing in the harbour close to the school were quite terrifying for all Rigu and Toniva residents. It was soon after this incident that Michael Chan and his family, longtime friends of the brothers, abandoned their home and store at Toniva and left Bougainville. In 1990, St. Joseph's High School opened with reduced numbers of students and staff as the escalating war affected people's ability to move freely around the island. By March, there were only 7 classes, as opposed to the original number of 12, and only 11 teachers. It was at this time that Brother Brian Leek, the deputy headmaster, began regular correspondence with Brother Des Howard, the district superior, and with Maris Brothers in Australia. In his long letters, Brian described everyday life at Rigu during the crisis years, providing news of the brothers and the daily progress of the war. This remarkable record of Central Bougainville events at the height of the crisis continued for 3 years, until Bryan's evacuation from the island in dramatic circumstances in December 1992. There were periods when, in spite of Bryan's contacts and resourcefulness, it was impossible to find ways to get his letters off the island. Nevertheless, Bryan continued writing, and when opportunities arose, a thick bundle of handwritten manuscripts would be secretly dispatched via safe hands, often through Solomon Islands. These priceless records provide a detailed picture of the last days of St. Joseph's Rigu. In 1990, the Rigu Maris community consisted of brothers Gonziga Nabbs, Brian Leake, and Julian Huckerman at Rigu, while brothers Bernard McGrath and Felix Koniana were living at Mabiring. During the first term, classes continued amid great uncertainty. For example, when services were withdrawn and Francis Ona declared Bougainville an independent nation in May, the grade 10s, realising there would be little chance of completing the PNG examinations, were in grave doubt about their educational future. Taking the examinations was never a possibility, as the school closed soon afterwards. For a time during the second term, Bryan assisted with some part-time teaching at Arawa High School, which at that stage was still operating with reduced staff. Rigu's headmaster, Julian Huckerman, explains that in the circumstances of the crisis, there was no possibility for continuing normal school operations. However, the forced closure of the school was a sad decision, one that still stirred emotions many years later. Quote, "When I reflect on these events so many years later, I still feel emotional with some tears in me. I think it's because I still have a soft spot for Rigu as a Catholic high school, which provided a good education for all Bougainville students, no matter where they came from, and gave them sound direction and meaning for their life. When we had to close Rigu, something important died on Bougainville." End of quote. Early in 1990, Julian travelled to Buka. He was stranded there for some time, and while he was driving back, his utility was commandeered by a BRA group, further delaying his return. The vehicle was sighted later but never recovered. Later, Julian returned to Buka and was once again stranded there for several months due to the dangers of highway travel. At Rigu, the brothers joined with other mission personnel, the priests, the CSN sisters and the BSJ brothers, for daily evening prayer in Tubiana Cathedral. No doubt their prayers often centred on the worsening situation on their island. In his spare time, Bryan, with many helpers, began scavenging the valuable materials from businesses which had been deserted by their expatriate owners. He took particular responsibility for trying to safeguard the store and personal possessions of Michael Chan's family. Bryan's aim was to protect the stock of numerous stores from rampaging looters. In time, every available secure space in the brothers' house and the school was packed with his valuable store goods. In the end, it was to no avail, as the school itself was looted and burned after Bryan's departure in 1992. However, these collections provided some temporary benefits for the brothers and other residents, as Bryan explains in his letter of 27 April 1990. Quote, "Meanwhile, not all has been sackcloth and ashes. We have inherited various good things as businesses close down and people depart. We have good supplies of frozen meat, and we enjoy a leg of lamb each week, once a week. We don't have champagne breakfast, but we are equipped for a couple at least. The BCL wine cellar still has a few bottles. The catering firm is selling us 11-litre tins of ice cream at 5 kina, so we regularly enjoy the treat. Assorted tinned food from Chan's provides a backup, with Peking curried duck being the last resort. Fresh fish abound nearby but seem to elude our experts. One sign of the times is a mouldy mailbag which has lain unused for 6 weeks. There must be a stack of our mail somewhere waiting for the good times to return. End quote. 2 months later, the situation was more serious. By this stage, there were no students at Rigu. They'd been told to wait at home until after the first term holidays. But regular school never resumed, although at times limited classes were held for small groups during the following 2 years. In June, electricity supply ended. Arawa town was virtually deserted, with no electricity, water, or sewerage services operating. The school's small generator was useful, but fuel was short. Quote from Brian's letter again. Petrol and diesel stocks have now run out. Soon, transport will be at a standstill. Any moving vehicle will be a target for fine collectors or vehicle collectors. Fortunately, we have a pleasant coastal location to walk around. We have a good stock of baked beans, spaghetti, tinned meat and fish. Some rice and kaukau, sweet potato, but no sugar, cordial, beer, eggs or fresh meat. End quote. The brothers' situation, including their diet, gradually became much worse over the ensuing months. There were occasional security scares at the school in 1990, when rascal groups attempting to steal from the collection of store goods that Brian held in protective custody. A big advantage for the brothers was that the area commander of the BRA was a Rigu ex-student from 1985, Joseph Sireona, and many of the BRA security patrols were ex-students as well. In this way, problems could be reported and effectively dealt with by higher-ranking sympathetic BRA officials. Later in the year, however, a Kongara BRA group came in at night and demanded that the group of girls, students from Nissan Island, who were staying in the mission, be given to them. Shots were fired into the water tanks. Brothers were threatened, and the sisters were terrified by demands that they come out of their house. Fortunately, the intruders left without carrying out their worst threats. Shortly after, the brothers were relieved when they were able to take the Nissan students and accompanying adults to Buka, which at that time was safer than Kiera. A heavily armed BRA escort accompanied the trucks on the highway north to Buka. Some months later, the Nissan people succeeded in finding transport to return to their island. During this period, various groups of displaced people moved into the mission area at Rigu and nearby Tubiana. With limited resources, the priests, brothers and sisters fed and cared for these people. Brian wrote on 18 October 1990, "We are managing okay. We get plenty of visitors, and a happy sharing community spirit has developed at the mission." End quote. The following excerpts from Brian's letters describe the situation in September and October of 1990. Quote, "The economy of the island has collapsed completely. There is no way of transporting or marketing produce. Many businesses have burned down, others completely ransacked. Most houses in Arawa have been demolished and materials carried away. Only 2 small trade stores are open in Arawa and none in Kiera. Stocks are limited as there have been no ships since April. Because of the fuel shortage, there are hardly any vehicles on the road now. Sadly, St. Mary's High School at Asatavi was ransacked and damaged recently. We drove up with some police to inspect the damage. Because of continuing threats and harassment at Asatavi, the SMSM sisters left Bougainville some months ago." That was on the 4th of September, 1990. And this next quote was written by Brian on the 12th of October, 1990. Gonzaga and I are still okay here, with ample supplies of basic medicine, tinned meat, baked beans and spaghetti. We swap our dwindling supplies of soap and fly spray for cow and bananas. Later, we'll have only toilet paper, duplicating paper, chalk and filing cabinets to barter with. We have an abundance of those. I gave our surplus clinic stocks to the hospital last week. End quote. As time went on, the brothers' hopes and everyone's hopes for an early resolution of the conflict faded, and Brian realised that all their work in salvaging store goods was probably futile, even though it provided constructive activity for the refugees living at Rigo and was a tangible sign that there really was a better future for Bougainville. Some of Brian's reflections on this issue follow. Quote, "All our efforts in the last month storing goods and equipment here following looting elsewhere may prove futile. So much has been spoiled. Our dormitories and classrooms are filled with material that we hoped could be used again with return to normalcy." That's 20th of September 1990. The next quote is from the 12th of October 1990. "It may turn out that our place will eventually be destroyed like everywhere else. However, we live in hope. We'll perhaps be one of the last to go. Maybe as that stage approaches, there may be enough people to stand up against the mindless destruction." End of quote. In November, Gonzaga Nabbs returned to Australia via Solomon Islands, while Brother Bernard Kangu from Rakera joined Brian Leake at Rigo. Earlier that month, there were several visits to Kieta Harbour by PNG Defence Force patrol boats, which on one occasion fired numerous rounds from machine guns towards Kieta and Rigo. In spite of rumours about an impending major attack by the PNGDF, the last weeks of 1990 passed quietly enough. Mabiri. Meanwhile, brothers Bernard McGrath and Felix Koniana were at Mabiri, Bernard having arrived there in May 1989 and Felix the following August. Bernard recalls those times at Mabiri. Quote, "I came to Mabiri to look at the possibility of starting a vocational school. That wasn't possible at the time because of the crisis. However, we did manage to run a few short courses in 1989 and 1990. We had a few workers here running the farm, but as the crisis intensified, they all eventually left. We had cocoa here then, as well as pigs and cattle. We looked after the assets at Mabiri and kept the farm going. Usually, life was fairly peaceful at Mabiri during those days. When the blockade started, things just got worse and worse. We had to ration our fuel, although we were able to get a few drums from the BRA. By the end of 1990, we had run out of most foodstuffs and were depending on our own food gardens, which were quite adequate. Sometimes we could get a bit of tinned meat from Brian's supply at Rigo. In 1991, Felix was away for about 6 weeks checking on his family at home in Boone. About that time, Brother Des Howard contacted me and suggested I could help Brother Julian Huckerman, who was about to reopen the high school at Hugena on Booker Island. So about Easter 1991, I left Bougainville, travelled through Solomon Islands to Australia, and back to Booker with Julian by the beginning of June." End quote. After Bernard's departure, Brother Felix, with the support of the nearby St. Joseph brothers and other helpers, including Felix's own brother Joseph, remained at Mabiri for a further 17 months. During that time, Felix organised classes for young and old, giving basic lessons and religious instruction to people in the nearby villages. Later, Felix spoke with great satisfaction about that period in his life, and it was with a lot of sadness that he left Bougainville for Solomon Islands in September 1992. Now, a few events from the year 1991. In February 1991, District Superior Brother Des Howard secured the necessary permissions and visited Rigu by travelling on a special Red Cross flight to Bougainville. Although he could stay for only a day, it was a great encouragement to the two brothers to see Des, who was able to see and experience what life was like on the crisis-torn island. The year progressed with the two brothers helping out at the mission, looking after the sick, caring for refugees, supporting various groups, working to restore education and health services, and doing whatever was needed to help people get on with life under these difficult circumstances. With virtually no goods coming into Bougainville, everyone, including the brothers, returned to a more basic lifestyle and a simple diet. In May 1991, representatives from overseas aid agencies, organised by Father Jim Carty, SM, stayed at the mission. The brothers were involved in many of their discussions. On one occasion, Bougainville Vice President Joseph Kabui, attending a meeting of this group in the brothers' house, laughed about sitting in one of his own chairs, which Brian had salvaged from the office of the Premier of North Solomons. Mr. Kabui was Premier of Bougainville until the onset of the crisis. In May 1991, Brian and Mr. Terry DeLilla began teaching about 20 students, mainly locals, from nearby Pokpok Island. Mathematics and English were the basic lessons taught, and classes operated from 8:30 a.m. until 1 p.m. One year after the closure of Rigu, they were happy to be back in the classroom. By 28 May, the number of students increased to 65, ranging from grade 7 to grade 12. A quote from Brian Leake's diary. School is in full swing. Four teachers, Terry DeLilla, Sister Elizabeth, Sister Sophie, and myself. 65 students in three groups, according to their educational background. We have 4 one-hour periods each day, followed by an hour of grass cutting. Our enrollment increases each day. The students are keen and cooperative, but they've forgotten a lot. End quote. In July, Brother John Mauro visited Corimera from Solomon Islands to visit his family, particularly his aging father. While at home, he visited Bishop Gregory Sinkai, who was spending an extended leave in his village. He also spent an enjoyable week with the brothers at Rigu. In October, another visitor from Solomon Islands, Brother Ray Arthur, spent some time with the brothers. And now 1992. The year began with a BRA capture of the ship MV Cosmaris, which had carried Red Cross supplies from Rabaul. The motivation for this action was complex, but one suggested reason was the 90 tons of trade store goods destined for Arawa had been offloaded at Rabaul before the ship sailed. That is a reference from the Post Courier newspaper dated 7 February 1992. The crew was terrified, but was adequately cared for by the BRA and, while held hostages, had the use of a house in Arawa with generator power and a refrigerator. Later, the BRA set fire to the MV Cosmaris, which sank, leaving its burnt-out hull partly visible at low tide. While awaiting transport to Solomon Islands, the crew spent a brief time at Rigu Mission. Brother Des Howard, visiting Rigu for 6 days in February, sent photographs of the scuttle ship to its owner, Marist ex-student Sir Henry Chow. Meanwhile, efforts to restore some form of education at Rigu and Arawa continued, as Brian reported in a letter early in the year, quote, classes resumed at St. Joseph's Rigu on 3 February with about 25 students undertaking courses in English, mathematics, social science, religious instruction, guidance and physical education. Mr. Terry DeLilla and Sister Elizabeth Rokope teach at Rigu. I teach some classes there, and for 3 days each week I help at Arawa High School, where there are 160 students at present, taught by 5 teachers and some volunteer helpers. At Arawa, along with the basic subjects, We have courses in panel beading, nursing, and home economics. The students at both schools are cooperating well." End quote. By March 1992, the PNGDF advance was creating great tensions around Kiera, especially when a group of soldiers landed on nearby Pok Pok Island. Soon afterwards, Rigu Mission became a care centre for Pok Pok refugee families. Gradually, many of the coastal communities moved up into the mountains because it was safer there than in the coastal villages, which could easily be fired on by PNGDF patrol boats. House arrest of Brother Brian Leek. Brian involved himself fully in the life of ordinary Bougainvillians and was not afraid to speak out with prudent caution against what he saw were blatant injustices. His letters to the brothers, to various politicians, and statements to the media at that time demonstrate a desire to be seen as neutral in the conflict, while clearly showing his commitment to supporting the Bougainvillean people in their suffering. In 1992, there was growing unease in the BRA command due to the increasing presence of PNGDF and to mounting problems among the various Bougainvillean factions. The BRA command tried to control the flow of information out of central Bougainville and wished to censor any report critical of themselves. In such circumstances, Brian's prolific correspondence and his access to the mission radio created suspicions, which ultimately led to the confiscation of the mission radio, a house arrest order which forbade him to leave the mission station, and a requirement that all his correspondence be cleared by the BRA. The tone and content of his correspondence became guarded from then on, as he became aware of his vulnerable situation. However, Brian continued to write freely and stored his letters until his departure. Plans which had been mooted about Brian taking a break from Bougainville had to be dropped for the time being. On the day of Brian's arrest, 18 April 1992, the BRA took him to Marae for questioning. He was not mistreated, but the ordeal was distressing for him, as it was for Bernard and the people at Rigu, who were aware of similar arrests and interviews from which the suspect never returned. For a week, Brian stayed with a priest at Marae under the watchful eye of the local BRA, some of whom were his own ex-students. Then the BRA commander drove Brian back to Rigu, much to the relief of Bernard and the Rigu mission staff. Brian learned from this experience that his situation was becoming increasingly vulnerable and that his continued presence on the island as one of the handful of remaining expatriates was becoming less feasible and less necessary. From then on, he depended on trusted Bougainvillians for his safety. During the ensuing months, life continued more or less peacefully at Rigu, which served as a refugee centre and temporary haven for families who had been displaced from their homes or were fearful of the threatened Defence Force offensive. Brian observed the rules restricting his travel and communication, but continued his work at Rigu in much the same way as before. Because of the increased tensions and uncertainties, the school classes at Rigu were suspended about mid-year of 1991. In August, Des Howard suggested that Brian apply for a BRA clearance to leave Bougainville. Plans were in place to ask Bertrand Webster, who knew Bougainville well, to replace him. Francis Ona, who was Bernard's ex-student, initially gave permission for Bernard to enter Bougainville, but with the deteriorating situation, Ona reversed that decision and Bertrand never came. Meanwhile, Brian began the negotiations for his own departure. In October, the landing of the PNG Defence Force at Tunuru Mission, north of Arawa, marked the next stage of the expected invasion. The Army's choice of the Catholic mission was unfortunate, as it created a rumour among non-sympathetic Bougainvillians that the Church was supporting the invasion. BRA forces deserted Arawa and nearby coastal areas, while the residents of Rigu, pressured by local BRA men, abandoned the mission and with numerous others, sought refuge in the hills above Kiera. Bernard Kangu decided to stay on at Rigu with some of the friendly BRAs and other friends. In November, Brian was taken to Marae for further interviews with BRA authorities. There he gained approval to leave Bougainville when an opportunity arose. It was clear that if he remained, he would create a dangerous situation for himself and his protectors. It was time to go. A dramatic departure. An opportunity came in December when Brian was given permission to join a group travelling in a 5-metre open boat to Solomon Islands. The BRA escort included the high-ranking Ishmael Torawama. Brian tells the story, quote, "On 15 December 1992, in the company of 11 others, including a sick woman, her 10-year-old son, a nurse, and a highly respected BRA escort, I started the journey from just south of Coromira in a 5-metre open speedboat. We travelled south, following the coastline for about half an hour, and were about to head out to sea when we saw an Iroquois helicopter patrolling the border we hoped to cross. We immediately changed course and headed full speed for the safety of the shore. The helicopter caught up with us, circled us, and opened fire with M16 machine guns and a grenade launcher. The spray of bullets came within 5 metres of our boat. Our escort fired a burst at the helicopter with his M16, resulting in our attackers keeping their distance. Reaching the shore, we scattered into the shelter of the light bush on the foreshore. The helicopter circled for 10 minutes, spraying M16 rounds into the trees and firing about 8 grenades towards us. Fortunately, none of us was injured. The chopper flew off, and after swamping our boat in the surf on our first attempt to get out to sea, we managed to head north to a nearby BRA camp where we serviced the motor and cleaned the fuel lines. We waited for evening when, under cover of darkness, we crossed the border without incident. However, the day's adventures were not yet over. A storm arose with lightning and rain, and in the darkness we lost direction. Chilled by rain and fear, I told Cecilia, our accompanying nurse, the story of our founder Marcelin Champagne's experience of being lost in the snow. I prayed the Memorare a few times with much feeling. We were relieved when a reflection of light on the clouds indicated to our crew the direction of a large sawmill in the far distance. Having established our position, the skipper confidently headed in the right direction until soon after we ran out of fuel. Undeterred, our crew and escort began paddling and set up a makeshift sail. 3 hours later, at 2 a.m. local time, we beached on Taro Island in Solomon Islands. I felt a great empathy for boat people everywhere. 4 hours later, we took another boat to Gizo, where Brother Ray Arthur welcomed me. Then followed a flight to Honiara, and some days later, to Australia. End of quote. Bernard Kangu's story. Meanwhile, back at Rigu, Bernard had problems of his own. Having farewelled Brian in mid-November, he continued his work, caring for the people who remained at the mission. Some days later, the arrival of some unwanted visitors at Rigu began a series of events which forced him to become a refugee himself, hiding in the mountains, out of contact with his brothers and family for 2 years. Here is Bernard Kangu's own story in his own words. It was 7 p.m. Sunday, 15 November 1992. One of my friends, a local BRA boy, came running to me with a warning. "Some BRA boys are here from Kongara. They're coming over to see you. Look out for them. They might bash you up." So I was waiting for them. When they arrived, they said, "We want the key to look inside your house." I said, "Sorry, I don't know you. This is my house. I cannot give you the key." And they bashed me up, bang, bang, bang. And they said, "We are the boss. We own everything. Open the house." They belted me with their closed fist and kicked me in the butt, using most horrible swear words. One of them pointed his gun at me and forced me to open the door. They searched the whole house and filled their bags up with anything of value. One of them said, "We're coming back here later tonight. You be here." Then someone shouted, "Brother, run! His gun is ready to fire. He's going to shoot you." So I ran behind the brother's house, where I hid behind a big hibiscus bush. They were searching for me everywhere, so I took off my white shirt so they wouldn't see me. "I have my own shirt here," he said, as he pointed to his black skin. So they couldn't see me. They looked around and called out, "We'll come back tonight and find you." When they left, the good BRA came and said, "Brother, you come with us now. Sleep with us at Tubiana Wharf." So I stayed with them until about 4 a.m. when I said, "Let's go back to Rigu. I want to collect a few things and run away up into the mountains." I collected some clothing. While it was still dark, they took me to Baba Village on the other side of the lagoon and left me there. After about a week, it still wasn't safe, so I fled into the mountains. I moved from village to village, eventually, in February 1993, settling with Thomas and Margaret Davayona and their 6 children in a small hamlet called Kietamo. During my years in exile, I helped the people prepare children for their first communion and helped out in running liturgies. I had my own garden during those years. Then at the end of 1994, when the ceasefire was declared, I surrendered myself to the PNGBF. They brought me to Buka. Eventually I got out to Port Moresby, where I met up with the brothers again. End of quote. The end of Rigu High School. As some had predicted, when the caretakers were forced to leave Rigu, the buildings fell victim to the senseless destruction which had already destroyed so much of Bougainville's infrastructure. Little is known of the incident which brought to a permanent end the long history of St. Joseph's High School, Rigu. Sometime in February 1993, an unknown group of BRA boys came into the mission area and fired the buildings. It is said the fire continued for some days. The jungle quickly encroached on the tangled metal and the broken brick. The statue of Champagne is there still, hidden in the jungle, covered with mould and lichen, his hand shot off, but otherwise intact. There he remains, a silent sentinel to what once was, a reminder of a former time. As a little addendum, some years later, when the crisis was over, the staff from Mabiri retrieved the statue and re-erected it in the grounds of Mabiri Centre, where it remains to this day, 2021. So ends that rather sad chapter 26, the end of Rigu High School. There's only one remaining, chapter 27, which will be posted shortly.